From WBUR Boston, I'm Jackie Leiden in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Syria has been on a long, slow 8-month burn, but lately the body count has spiked and a new ugly phase may have begun. Syria makes Libya look like child's play. It's a much more critical domino in the Arab Spring with big implications for all the neighbors and for the U.S. This hour on Point, Syria on the brink and what it means for U.S. policy. You can join the conversation. Where do you think Syria is headed? And how ugly will this get inside Syria and in the region? And joining me now from Beirut is Nada Bakri, a reporter for The New York Times. Welcome to the program, Nada.
Hi, Jackie.
Would you please take us through where things are today? Over the weekend, there were some new reports of attacks on buildings inside and near Damascus, more sectarian violence edging into some of this. Just please bring us up to date.
Well, Jackie, you know, it was interesting, actually, in recent days or in the past week, the events that happened. We saw last week an attack, and it was a first of its kind, an attack on an Air Force intelligence installation in Harista near Damascus. And then just 3 days later, there was another attack on the offices of the Ba'ath Party inside Damascus. And there was also, before that, another attack on Ba'ath Party in Idlib in northern Syria. These attacks, of course, there were attacks on the security forces, on the army since the beginning of the uprising, but we're hearing more and more of them, and they're, you know, increasing, and the nature of them is been so brazen lately and so courageous. You know, they're not inflicting any damages, per se, on these buildings.
Well, Nada, if I could just jump in here for a moment. What is the speculation about exactly who is behind these, or is it unknown?
Well, there's not much speculation to say, because the Free Syrian Army, which is a group of army defectors based out of southern Turkey, or its leaders are based out of southern Turkey, they are claiming responsibility for almost every one of these attacks on buildings or on buses or military vehicles. So they, you know, as soon as the attack is broadcasted, they say that we are responsible for this attack, and they post that on whether a video on YouTube or on their Facebook page. But now you have activists saying that they might not be responsible for all these attacks, mm-hmm. and that you know, it could be just any insurgents inside Syria or any defectors inside Syria who are not a part of the Free Syrian Army, but that the Free Syrian Army is just capitalizing on any attack.
Let me ask you about something else, Nada. The New York Times published a report over the weekend on Sunday by your colleague Anthony Shadid, talking about, in homes at least, more sectarian tinges to the violence. And this is, of course, a fear. As we know, the death count has really spiked, according to the UN, 3,500 people thus far over the last 8 months. But what about this sort of thing between Alawites and Sunni Muslims in some of the larger cities like Homs?
You know, that was very, very interesting, the events that are happening in Homs. You know, it feels to a lot of people inside Homs and outside Homs, you know, activists and observers, that it's almost like a civil war there with all the sectarian fighting that's going on, the kidnappings, the assassinations. People are afraid to cross into neighborhoods. Muslim Sunnis are afraid to cross into an Alawite neighborhood, and vice versa. You know, families are not allowing their children to mix with with other children from different sects and religions. It's just there's a lot more things that we don't know about, and this is, I'm sure, just a few of the examples that are just few examples of what's happening inside Homs, mm-hmm. and people tell you it's a lot worse than this.
Are activists who had been leading this uprising, do they decry this sort of these kidnappings and disappearances that we've been reading about?
Yeah, that's a good question, because there are several types of activists. There are activists who do not mention any of these killings or kidnappings or assassinations. They completely tell you it's not happening. They deny it. There are those who actually, follow it and give you a lot of details about it, and they're warning against it. There's even some opposition figures, like the Syrian National Council's spokesperson, Dr. Burhan Ghilyun. He on Saturday, addressed people in Homs and elsewhere in Syria, and warning them against the dangers of sectarian fighting and, calling for calm and restraint and ending these acts of violence in Homs.
Okay, well, thank you very much for being with us. Nada Bakri is a reporter from the New York Times, and she joined us from Beirut in neighboring Lebanon, of course. And we'll turn now to a Syrian businessman. He's joining us from somewhere in the Persian Gulf. He fled Damascus earlier this year. He still has family in Syria, and so he asks that we not use his name, and we'll comply. Welcome, and thank you for being with us on On Point.
Thank you, Jackie. Hi.
Hi. I know that you are following things that happen in Syria through phone calls, through Skype, Twitter. Tell us what you are hearing about.
Well, I mean, on the humanitarian level, the situation is really bad. I just heard a report from a friend of my kid who is living in Homs. He goes to a very prestigious school there. And because of the situation there, he was telling my son that they were sleeping in the corridors of the house. And when they wake up in the morning, they find bullet holes above on the walls. So as a result of that, his family decided to move out from Homs and to move to Damascus, to relocate to Damascus. And they transferred their kids to the school.
I just want to make a small point here. Homs is it the third largest city in Syria, central Syria?
Yes. Yes, it is. After Damascus and Aleppo, it is the third largest city.
With an ethnic mix of predominantly Sunni Muslims, but also some of the minority, but reigning party Alawites, and then, of course, a significant minority Christian population. So what else about the humanitarian situation there?
Can you repeat?
What else about the humanitarian situation?
The humanitarian situation. Well, I'm told that, for example, right now they have a great shortage of diesel in the country as a whole, but mainly right now in Homs there are no supplies of diesel. And you have to bear in mind that heating in Syria, domestic heating, relies on diesel. On top of that, you know, there are the gas cylinders, butane gas. Usually it's supplied in canisters, and they have not been delivered to Homs as well. But there is a great deal of shortage. It's like a collective punishment by the government to the population. And in a way, it's like they are trying to give them a message that because of these revolutionaries, you are getting these shortages. It's not because of us.
Have you been hearing anything more about internecine fighting, ethnic fighting, sectarian violence?
Well, we are hearing these reports, but what is interesting, I've heard Nada talking about some of the reports which have been mentioned about Homs. But an interesting thing, that there was a statement signed by both Alawite and Sunni sheikhs this morning, and it was published, and in which they denounce all sectarian killings, and they issued an edict that whoever carry out from either party such a killing would be considered a non-Muslim.
Hmm. So clearly there is a fear that things could descend there, and that would, of course, really complicate matters.
Absolutely, yes. That's correct.
Any response to the Arab League's move to suspend Syria? Have you heard anything like that, about a reaction to that from activists on the streets?
Yes, I mean, this has been, many people were very sort of euphoric about it, and they felt it's quite encouraging sign, because for a long time they felt that there was no reaction on the Arab level, even on the international level. I mean, they felt that the Americans and the Europeans were giving a lip service to in terms of supporting the revolution. But now we are seeing some concrete step. Mind you, they are still giving the regime what they call ultimatums, deadlines, and the people are saying that these are deadlines or ultimatums, so they would be more bloodshed.
And we've only got about a minute left in this segment. What do you think the U.S. should do?
The U.S.? Well, I think the U.S. should not be involved directly, but should be supportive of the international efforts to support the opposition, you know, the different parts of the opposition, and to exercise some pressure on the opposition groups to unify themselves and come out with one voice. So they would be able to present a reasonable agenda to replace the current regime.
Are your friends still leaving Syria?
Excuse me?
Are your friends and family, are people still fleeing Syria as you yourself have? You're a refugee living elsewhere?
Yes. I mean, just to give you a practical example, somebody called me from Damascus yesterday. His son just went into medical school there. And they cannot attend the university. They hardly attended anything, so he wants to transfer him out of Syria. And what I said to a friend this morning, you know, this year is a lost year for all the Syrians, you know, for the adults because they are losing their livelihood, they are not getting any income. For the kids, the kids are forced to go out on these demonstrations,
okay,
which showing that they are supporting President Assad.
A lost year for the Syrian people. Thank you so much for calling in. This is On Point. I'm Jackie Lydon in for Tom Ashbrook. We're watching Syria's slow burn and trying to figure out if it's about to explode into all-out civil war and what the whole Syria question means for the United States. Now, in an interview last Friday in Bali, Indonesia, with NBC's Chuck Todd, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton all but ruled out a Libya-type U.S.-led military operation for Syria. But she didn't hedge on how the U.S. sees the story unfolding. The final chapter, she says, doesn't include the Assad regime.
Libya was a unique situation, and every place is, I think, but it's not applicable to Syria. Syria has its own kind of rhythm, and what the Arab League has done is an unmistakable signal to Assad that you're done.
Joining me now from Washington is Robin Wright, veteran journalist and Middle East analyst, now a senior fellow at the United States Institute of Peace. And her last book, a really prescient take on the region, was called Rock the Casbah, Rage and Rebellion Across the Islamic World. Robin, welcome back to On Point.
Nice to be with you, Jackie.
Robin, is Syria the most important thing right now in the Middle East? Is it more important than what's unfolding? I have to ask you, you are a Middle East veteran, more important than what's unfolding in Egypt right now?
Well, these are the two most important countries of the 22 Arab League members. The fact is Egypt accounts for one quarter of the Arab world's 300 million people. And what is happening in Egypt now is really pivotal because it is a second phase in the uprising. But for the dynamics across the region, Syria is critical because if Syria, after 40 years of rule by a father and son Assad dynasty, does move into a political transition, this has repercussions for not only other states but also the regional dynamics, whether it's the Arab-Israeli conflict, the broader issues of the U.S. military presence in the region, what happens in Little Lebanon, Turkey, which is a NATO ally of the United States, Iraq, where we have troops, Jordan, where the king has been a strong ally of the United States. So the repercussions really are very strong. And I think that I think there's a general consensus within the United States, among analysts in the region, that President Assad cannot survive this process politically, but he can string it out in a way that thousands more people will die in the months ahead by this kind of agreement to go along with the Arab League on reforms and then backing away from them and then demanding compromises, that he can string this out in a way that turns out to be bloodier for the people he he rules today.
Robin, you've been around Washington a long time. What do you make of the switch in position last spring, last March? Secretary of State Hillary Clinton was more than hinting that Bashar al-Assad was going to be a reformer or in the reformist camp or something like that by August. We had President Obama saying the future of Syria must be determined by its people, but that President al-Assad was standing in the way. Obviously, it's driven by the repression and violence that we've seen. But is there something else that's coming from Middle East leaders that the United States has had to take into account?
Well, 2011 has been not only important in the shift in the region, in the Middle East, it's also marked one of the most important shifts in U.S. policy in over 60 years, as the United States gradually in February began to understand that some of its stalwart allies, such as President Hosni Mubarak in Egypt, could not survive the turmoil on the streets. And so the United States took that initial position, shifting to not call for him to be allowed to stay until elections would create a natural cycle for him to move aside. They basically called on him to resign. And I think the United States has begun to see that what began in Tunisia and now has changed the leadership in Egypt and Libya too is likely to affect most of the countries in some way over the next 5 to 10 years. And that's been reflected in what the Arab League has done on Syria. This is the first time you've seen this club of dictators take a very strong stand against one of their own. And they did with Muammar Gaddafi, but he was on the sidelines of the political mainstream. President Assad and Syria have been in the mainstream. They have been critical players in all the issues of the region. And to take such a strong stand against Syria really reflects the growing change and the sense that the leaders understand that their own futures may be at stake and what they do about these uprisings.
I definitely want to talk about U.S. policy, but let's just pause for a moment with what the Arab League has done. Now, as you know, it was just the third time in its history that it had suspended a membership like this. But it called for, 500 Arab League monitors to come in Syria, pushed back on that. I guess there's supposed to be another meeting tomorrow. Politically significant, but is it really changing much on the ground?
No, but there is a sense of growing isolation by the community itself, so that when the King of Saudi Arabia turns around and says that President Assad no longer has credibility, and then the King of Jordan calls on him to step aside, the President of Turkey, who has actually joined in the discussions in the Arab League and it's not a member, has called on the regime to open up, to not use violence against its own people, has even threatened to turn off electricity, you begin to see the dynamics in the region shifting against the regime. And that is, I think, a remarkable turning point in the region. Syria used to be the one who played the spoiler, and now it's finding it no longer has the leverage to do that. And then with the Europeans cutting off oil supplies, the real challenge to the Assad regime now is going to be to survive economically. 95% of its oil exports go to Europe. So you see the reaction by the political actions by the people in the region, the economic sanctions imposed by particularly the European Union, beginning to put a real slow squeeze on the regime.
Yeah, and as we heard from, I hope you heard the man who had defected, possibly a hoarding of resources by the regime itself. I just wanted to ask you a bit about Syrian army defectors who've met with Russia's foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov. I hope I'm pronouncing that properly. That took place last week. Is that significant?
Well, it's important because Russia and China are two veto-wielding members of the United Nations, and the West, particularly the British, the French, Germans, United States, have all been pushing for some kind of resolution at the United Nations that would make it easier to rally sanctions measures by the international community that would be punitive against the regime. And they've been unsuccessful because, particularly of Russia. And Sergei Lavrov, the foreign minister, after meeting with the defectors, was critical of the use of violence and basically implied that the regime was justified because of the attacks on its intelligence facility, Ba'ath Party headquarters, in using violence to counter the defectors' strikes. So the international community does not yet speak with one voice, and the Russians play a disproportionate role, particularly because they have been primary arms sources for the Syrian regime.
All right. Thank you, Robin. Don't go away. Joining us now also in Washington is Karim Sajjadpour. He's the Middle East expert at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, one very significant expert. And he's also a former chief Iran analyst for the International Crisis Group. He's been based in Tehran and Washington, D.C. Karim, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. My pleasure.
I wanted to ask you as well, what do you think the Iranian involvement in Syria is at this point?
Well, Syria, the government of the Assad government in Syria, has been the Islamic Republic of Iran's really only consistent ally since the 1979 revolution. And if you say that the crown jewel of the Iranian revolution has been Hezbollah, the political militia in Lebanon, Syria has been absolutely critical to Iran's patronage of Hezbollah. So I would argue that the Assad regime in Syria is not only Iran's key ally in the Middle East, but you could argue on a global level it's been an absolutely critical relationship for the Islamic Republic of Iran. So I would imagine that the Iranian regime is probably doing a couple of things. On one hand, it's doing everything in its power to make sure that the Assads don't fall, whether that is offering them financial credits, subsidized oil, offering them help, and whether it's tactical or strategic help and helping to quell the uprisings. I think they're certainly doing that. But it's reached such a point in Syria where I think that the Iranian government has been forced to contemplate the collapse of the Assad regime. And in the last weeks, we've seen reports, news reports, of the saying that the Iranian elements of the Iranian government have met with elements of the Syrian opposition. So this is pretty significant. For the first time, Iran is contemplating that they may have to deal with a post-Assad order in Syria.
I also want to talk about some other voices that we're hearing from Washington. Yesterday, former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice spoke on CNN's State of the Union, and she hinted at a broader proxy war on the wings as the Syria regime teeters.
He is driving his country to the brink of civil war. That's very clear. And it's a very dangerous circumstance, and Syria is no friend of the United States. Syria is the handmaiden of the Iranians throughout the region, and so the fall of Bashar al-Assad would be a great thing, not just for the Syrian people, that's first and foremost, but also for the policies of the United States and those who want a more peaceful Middle East.
Do you think it would be a great thing for the policies of the United States, Karim Sajjadpour?
Well, if you argue that the chief impediment to stability in the Middle East is the Islamic Republic of Iran, I think many in the U.S. government would make that argument, then what's bad for Iran is then good for the United States from this viewpoint. But it's not, I think anyone who knows Syria well is reluctant to make predictions about what will happen in Syria when Assad is no longer around. And I think that this is also an Israeli concern as well, that on one hand, if you argue that, well, if the fall of Assad is bad for Hezbollah and it's bad for Iran, then that means it's good for Israel on one hand. But on the other hand, it is within the realm of possibilities that you could have a government come to power in a post-Assad era, which is far more Islamist in nature, and in a way far more radical toward Israel and toward the United States. So I think it remains a big question mark how the developments in Syria will play out within the region and how they will be for the United States and for Israel.
Let me ask you that same question, Robin Wright. If the Assad regime were to topple, well, certainly probably there are already plans for what the post-Assad Syria response by the United States would be, some in Washington, no?
Well, the United States is creating some contingency funds in the event that something transpires in Syria. but no one knows exactly what that would involve. And Karim is right. The real unknown is what it would, what the a new government would look like. And it's clear that the longer this goes on, the greater dangers that you have angrier citizens looking for more radical alternatives. There's a great fear that because the Sunnis are the majority, that this will lead to the rise of an Islamist party. Now, there is a nascent national council, including many exiles, some Islamists, and apparently some from inside Syria who don't want to be publicly named. They had a formal meeting in Istanbul to get organized and to get launched, but they don't have a relationship with the Free Syrian Army, for example, that is including the defectors that have apparently launched some of these attacks. So there is not the kind of unity that would give us a sense, as we saw, for example, in Libya, of what an opposition government would look like, who the big players are, and what their agenda is.
Let's take a couple of calls. We're talking about the Syrian regime. What happens if it falls? We're talking to Stephen, who's calling from Windham, Connecticut. Welcome to On Point, Stephen.
Hey, thanks, Jackie. You know, after months of peaceful protests, you know, these Syrians are so courageous. They're so heroic in my eyes. I mean, their dignity cannot be denied. I think it's time that we arm these guys. You know, they have a right for self-defense. Maybe even consider putting up a no-fly zone over the city of Homs. I think it's time for the France and UK to take the lead in arming these protesters so that they can have, you know, they can have self-defense.
All right. Thank you, Stephen. Robin Wright, is there any contemplation of NATO taking some kind of action similar to what we saw in Libya?
No, NATO has actually said it doesn't intend to play a role anyplace else in the Middle East. Libya was in many ways a unique case, both because of its leadership and because of some of the logistics. The reality is that Syria is a much tougher place to engage in a no-fly zone, much more complicated in terms of where what kinds of facilities might have to be attacked if they open fire. This is a time also that France and Germany are dealing with a real economic crisis across Europe, and no one has the extra funds to engage in what would be a costlier, probably longer engagement in Syria, one that's much more complicated and has regional aspects, including Hezbollah and Iran, and the kinds of things that might be set off if NATO got involved. This is something I don't think that is likely to happen anytime soon, and even the idea of arming them is much more likely to be something Saudi Arabia, for example, might do in helping the Sunni majority in Syria. But I don't foresee the West playing a critical role, except when it comes to the issue of economic sanctions. And this is an area where the West has much more influence and actually can make a profound difference in a country that has a very small foreign exchange reserve, relies on the West to buy its oil.
Karim, we've just got about a minute left in this segment, but what about on the other side? Are any Syrian allies sending more materiel to the regime itself?
Well, it's very nebulous, the relationship, for example, Syria has with Iran. We all know the nature of the relationship, but in terms of Iranian arms going to Syria and sources of repression, we have to believe that, again, the Iranian regime is doing everything in its power to buoy Syria. But I think, as Robin says, there's a reluctance on both sides to get into some type of a regional war or you know, accelerate some type of a civil war.
This is On Point. I'm Jackie Lydon, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're watching Syria today and asking what it means if the crucially important, critically located regional power broker erupts into all-out civil war. My guests this hour are Robin Wright, Middle East analyst, a senior fellow at the United States Institute of Peace and author of Rock the Casbah, and Karim Sajjadpour, a fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Let's go to your calls. France is calling from London, Kentucky, I believe. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jackie.
Hi. Your comment, is it France or Francie?
Just France, yes. France mostly. I am a doctor in rural Kentucky now, but before I came home, I worked for 5 years in Cincinnati. And while I was there, I worked closely with several doctors who were from Syria. One of the enjoyable parts of my job was finding out how much someone from eastern Kentucky had in common with someone from Syria. One would never have thought that that was the case, only it was. And getting past religion, past where you were born, past all the superficial things that we thought on the surface kept us apart, and finding that beyond all that, there's so much in common, was just enjoyable. It made true friendship.
Have you maintained any of those friendships, France?
Yes. We're close friends. There are not the differences between religion. I grew up in a fiercely Pentecostal family. They grew up in fiercely Islamic families. And we both feel pride in our religious background, and as adults are comfortable being friends with someone who's not in the same denomination.
Well, thank you for calling in and making that point that that Syria is not monolithic when it comes to religion any more than the United States. Robin Wright, you've been there for many visits, a number of holidays. Tell us a little bit about the religious and ethnic composition of Syria.
Well, Syria has both minorities in terms of ethnicity and religion. 11% of the country is Alawite, which is an offshoot of Shiism. The Alawites have dominated the political structure now for 40 years. And one of the problems is that many other communities don't feel that they are proportionately represented. But there is a 10% Christian population, and I've been in Damascus during Easter, and it's quite interesting. You go around to the shops, and because Syria honors both the Roman Easter and the Orthodox Easter, which are on different weekends, you will see for weeks chocolate Easter bunnies in windows, colored eggs, that there is a sense that this is a holiday that is honored in Syria too, and everyone, Muslim and Christian, gets the holiday off. But you also have a 10% Kurdish population, which underscores the ethnic differences in the country. And where the Kurds and where the Christians have been particularly important. The Kurds, because of the assassination of one of its leaders, have increasingly sided with the opposition or have not been willing to side with the regime. So we've seen a threshold crossed in the past couple of months that's really important for this minority. Mm-hmm. When it comes to the Christians, however, they have not been as visible in the opposition. And I think that one of the fears is that if the Sunni majority should take power in a post-Assad regime, that the Christians might have a tougher time. And so the Christians have been sitting on the fence, predominantly not been willing to take a side in this fight.
Karim Sajapour, do you see a Sunni-Shiite divide bubbling beneath in a grayer geopolitical way here vis-a-vis what's going on in Syria?
The thing about Syria, which is different than Iraq, for example, is that there's a far greater disparity in these sectarian and ethnic cleavages, as Robin was mentioning. You do have diversity, but you have a Sunni majority, which is upwards of 70-75% of the country, whereas in Iraq, you had much more parity between the Shiites and the Sunnis and the Kurds. But One point to mention, which is applies in Syria and it applies in Egypt, and it's a concern throughout the region, is that we may have situations in which the post-autocratic order of some of these places, whether it's Egypt or Syria, in some ways can be less tolerant towards its, especially the religious minorities, than the autocratic order was. I know that in Egypt, for example, there's tremendous concern among the Egyptian, the Christian, the Coptic community, that under Hosni Mubarak, they were in some ways more protected than in the current situation. And for the reasons which Robin mentioned, there has been tremendous ambivalence among the Syrian Christian community, that, they may view Bashar al-Assad as a dictator, But he's the devil that they know, and they've been able to live in an Assad regime. And if you have a post-Assad regime, which is Sunni fundamentalist, it may be much tougher times for Christians. And I think that in the broader Middle East, when you're talking about the interests of Saudi Arabia and the interests of Iran, the concern of religious minorities isn't a huge driving force. But certainly for the communities themselves, it's a huge source of concern.
Let's go to Michael, who's calling from Atlanta, Georgia. Welcome to On Point, Michael.
Hello, Jackie. I've got a quick question, and that concerns Syria's chemical weapons capabilities and under what conditions they'd be willing to use them, and also what happens if the Syrian government does fall to those chemical weapons. And I'll take my reply off the air. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Robin Wright, would you like to tackle that?
Well, Syria has clearly had nuclear ambitions, as we saw in the development of a secret facility that Israel bombed a couple of years ago. And so we know that that the regime is prepared to use weapons of mass destruction. One would assume they have a chemical weapons capability. I don't personally know what it has or what it might use, but it's clear that the Iraqi use of chemical weapons against its own people was so unpopular that the regime, if it has it, will know the costs and the consequences in terms of condemnation from the international community, that might be a step that pushes the world across the threshold to, for example, impose a no-fly zone or get involved in some broader way.
Karim, I'd like to ask you a question about Arab leaders and whether they see the collapse of the Assad regime as something of an opportunity to undermine Iran. We've certainly seen that kind of power struggle go on in neighboring Iraq. What about here?
Certainly for a country like Saudi Arabia, which sees itself in a battle for regional power and influence with the Islamic Republic of Iran, the fall of the Assad regime would be, in their eyes, a tremendous blow to Iran, because you have a situation in which an Alawite minority, the Assad family, is ruling over a Sunni majority. And the idea is that if, you know, the Assads were to fall, the Sunni majority would obviously, would likely come to power, and they would likely alter their serious foreign policy to align itself more with Sunni Saudi Arabia than Shiite Iran. So I think that's certainly a factor. But what's interesting is historically, these countries, especially countries like Saudi Arabia, have been countries which want to preserve the status quo in the region. There have been countries which are averse to change for some of the reasons which Robin mentioned. And there was a line once, I'm not sure who said it the first time, but someone once said about Egypt that when there's tumult in Egypt, Egypt implodes. But Syria has the potential to explode and carry its internal tumult beyond its borders. So I really think that it defies prediction what a post-Assad order would look like and whether that would absolutely benefit Saudi Arabia and absolutely be to the detriment of Iran. Certainly that's what you would expect in terms of the trend lines, but it truly does defy prediction.
We have a call now from Omar, who is calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Welcome to On Point, Omar.
Hi, Jackie. I am a Syrian-American. I've lived in Boston for over 10 years now. I lived most of my life in Damascus. I am a Sunni. It really never occurred to me to think about Syria as Sunni and Shia and Alawi. What I see is happening now, and what a lot of my Christian friends and Alawi friends are seeing, is that the regime is playing this card as the last card to stay in power, trying to use this scare tactic that we've seen during the Bush era. And I know for a fact that many Christians and many Alawi actually are opposing to this regime, but we are all scared of, we've got threats for families, and we're scared of any retaliations against most of our families who are still living over there.
Do you think, Omar, when you look at the entire Middle East uprising movement that we've seen, the overthrow of leaders, pushback by the military, do civilians seem to be getting lost in the mix when you talk to your friends?
The civilians?
Mm-hmm.
You know, in Syria, I think one of your people on the show said that we're not oppositions. The civilians, the Syrian civilians, they're probably lost in the middle, but they are now in the heart of the problem. We were never oppositions. I mean, we were born to live with this regime. We were okay, but I think what changed us all is seeing the blood of the Syrian youth or the Syrian citizens, civilians, spilled in the streets without any spare. It's not about the Alawi, it's not about the Shia, it's about certain, I would say, couple families who hijacked the Alawi sector totally, and the Alawi are the most scared now as part of the Syrian society because they're fearing any uprising against them after this regime fails, if it fails.
Thank you so much for your call, Omar. Let's take another call. Caesar is calling from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Welcome to On Point, Caesar.
Thank you, Jackie. I'm of Lebanese origin, and just to comment about the possible effects of this conflict on neighboring countries, especially Lebanon, which is deeply entrenched in the effects of the Syrian regime for a number of years. The prospect of all-out war in Syria is very scary to the Lebanese people. And just watching a debate on TV last week where one guest was aligned with the Syrian regime and the other guest is not. They almost got into a fight and throwing chairs at each other and obscenities. Imagine what could happen if war breaks out in Syria. That would reignite the Lebanese conflict, and that's a scary thought.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I needed. That's all that's going on in my mind. Thank you for letting me share my comments.
Thanks for calling in, Caesar. Robin Wright, when you look at Syria, do you ever find yourself thinking about what a different day it is and what confronts the 11-year presidency of Bashar al-Assad compared to his father?
Absolutely. I lived in Beirut for 5 years and watched across the border at Syria, and I have been dumbfounded, frankly, about how resilient the opposition has been, how they have persevered despite the use of such brutality, not only in killing some 3,500 people, according to the United Nations, but in the arrests of an estimated 70,000, and that people still turn out and are engaged in peaceful civil disobedience, as well as the recent attacks. This signals the scope of dissent in Syria and really across the region. And clearly, your last caller is right, that the Lebanese are particularly nervous because Syria long claimed Lebanon as part of Syria historically and occupied it for almost three decades. And whatever happens in Syria always spills over into Lebanon, which is even more fragmented. It has 17 recognized religious sects. And so there is concern about what impact Syria's disorder will have on Lebanon, which went through its own bloody civil war for 15 years.
Let's take one more call. John is calling from Shrewsbury, Massachusetts. Welcome to On Point, John.
Thanks for taking my call. I'll be very brief. The United States stop acting like an empire and simply mind our own business. We have nothing to do with on in Syria. We're involved from the Pacific with Obama to the Middle East at the cost of trillions, untold trillions of dollars. It is not, if may be anticipated,
okay.
have anything to do with human rights.
Your phone call is fading out, I'm afraid, John, a little bit, and it's hard to hear you, but I think the gist of what you're saying is that we should stay out of it. Karim Sachapour, is that really an option? I mean, what is the next front? Is the next front the UN? And just very briefly, I know you were at China recently. What about China?
Well, there's this real dichotomy at the moment, Jackie, because on one hand, the United States has tremendous concerns of its own on the home front. And when I talk to members of Congress, whether they're from the right or the left, they constantly say that their constituents want us to do nation building at home. They want to reduce our presence in the Middle East and do nation building at home. But when you have a situation like you have in Syria, which you and Robin and the callers have talked about, where you have upwards of 3,500 civilian casualties, tremendous brutality, it's very tough, as the caller suggested, for us to just sit on our hands and watch from afar. And I think it's very difficult for the Obama administration to take the tech. That's the approach of the Chinese government, simply say that we don't interfere in the internal affairs of other countries. But the United States has a much different nature and a different foreign policy than China.
Well, I want to thank you both very, very much for being with us from Washington today. Karim Sachapour, fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and Robin Wright, Middle East analyst and a senior fellow at the United States Institute of Peace, and author of Rock the Casbah. And you can continue the conversation online by looking us up on Point Radio, Twitter and Facebook. I'm Jackie Leiden, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook, and you're listening to On Point, and thank you again.